This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, Music from DePauw. This week, two of our student producers interview DePauw music majors about playing in the Opera Pit Orchestra and competing in national vocal competitions. Professor Scott Spiegelberg introduces us to Shostakovich's first piano concerto. We showcase some outstanding recent performances by DePauw music students, and I talk with viola professor Nicole Brockman about a fascinating recital in which the audience chooses the winner and the big reveal comes at the end. There are lots of exciting things going on in the DePauw School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. This has been a busy week of travel for me, and fortunately the Music for Life staff have ably stepped in, and we're thrilled to open our show this week with a piece from student producer Anna Gadula.
Welcome to the Student Corner. I'm student producer Anna Gadula. Today I'm joined by Joey Lepic.
Hello.
Eric Erlinson.
Hi.
And Lucas Wassmer.
Hi.
Congratulations. At the last student recital hour, Dean McCoy announced that you guys had some successes in some vocal competitions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So how did you guys hear about these competitions? And what were the specific competitions that you each participated in? Joey?
We're all in Caroline Smith's studio. She's our voice professor, and she often forwards us these competitions in emails or lets us know about them in our lessons. That's usually how we find out about them. And I competed in the Indianapolis Matinee Musicale competition in Indy.
Eric?
I have not competed yet, but I submitted my information and got accepted into the competition of Orpheus in Tennessee.
Oh, excellent. Lucas?
Like Eric, I haven't competed yet, but I submitted my recordings and was accepted into the competition for FAVA. It's the Franco-American Vocal Academy.
Excellent. So, Joey, since you are the only one who actually went through an actual audition process, what was it like? Was it scary?
Yeah, it was a pretty scary experience, but it's like most auditions. I went into a classroom, I sang my repertoire, and I left.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a nervous experience.
And how did you feel when you came out of the audition?
I felt relieved, but it wasn't like traditional competitions because we didn't find out the results. There was no, like, result announcement afterwards. Mm-hmm. We didn't find out by email, and she didn't tell us when we would get this email, but she said it would be sometime during the night.
Mm-hmm. How vague.
So yeah, it was kind of a bad way to do it because I felt like I was just sitting there really nervous checking my phone for emails all the night, and I ended up not finding out until the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
The afternoon that I won second place.
Was it more nerve-wracking knowing that this competition had money earnings?
Yeah, it was more nerve-wracking, I'd say. Most competitions do have money involved with them, but it's always like an extra incentive. It mm-hmm. kind of pushes you further.
So you guys, everyone, how did you react to your results, finding out you made semifinals, finding out that you made the top 10? How did you react to that? Lucas?
I mean, it was pretty exciting. They didn't like send me a personal email. I was just kind of like waiting for a month after I sent in my recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got like the group email that they send to like everybody
mm-hmm.
on their mailing list. And it was like, here's the top 10 finalists. And I was like, oh, I guess this is, and I scrolled down and there was my name. So
it was actually really funny because I am auditioning for FAVA this year for the summer program. So mm-hmm. I guess they put me on the email list too. And
yeah.
they sent me the email yeah. and I was like, oh my gosh, Lucas Wassmer!
There's somebody I know.
Yeah, I didn't even know that he was competing in this competition. So it was funny that
yeah.
I found out your results through the general organization.
Yeah, and I got a lot of texts from friends and that I made in like other summer programs
mm-hmm.
that also like auditioned or like are on that list somehow.
And Joey?
I did the FAVA summer program in Austria. They do summer programs abroad, and I'm on that mailing list too. And so I know a lot of people that have done that competition. It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, Eric, how did you react to your results?
To be honest, I was a little confused because the letter they sent in the mail was from a university in Tennessee, and I was really confused because I thought it was for a grad school application, and
mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm not looking anywhere in Tennessee, so I don't know what this is for, and then I got it, and I was actually quite excited. Also forgot that I even applied, but it was a nice little treat.
So after hearing about these results, where do you guys go from there? Eric?
I get to travel on down to Tennessee for the competition. It's in Murfreesboro, which I have no idea where that is. So that'll be fun. But this will help prepare me for my upcoming grad school auditions that I have, mostly in the Midwest and one in Louisiana. So I'm really looking forward to everything that I'm going to learn through this experience, the networking, you know.
Lucas?
Yeah, the networking is a big thing. I mean, the reason you do summer programs and like a big reason you do these competitions is like if you get it. Me personally, yeah, I had to fly out to Austin, Texas, and there's like a big panel of people on FAVA, but there's also a big panel of people that are actually judging the competition. So the FAVA people don't judge it. They bring in like outside people who are like big name people in the opera performing world. So yeah, I'm going to Texas on March 1st. So it's pretty
awesome.
Cool.
We'll have fun down there. And Joey?
For me, it was, I mean, it was a check in the mail, and it was a lot of affirmation about, it gave me a confidence booster personally that I was able to place second in this kind of, it was a big competition, and I felt really good about the results. And you know, it felt like a step in the right direction for me as I'm like pursuing all these big summer programs and things. And it felt good to kind of get that affirmation that I'm doing the right thing for now.
Good. Excellent. So, Eric, what is it like working with accompanists that you don't know?
Well, in my experiences, it varies quite a bit between accompanists and accompanists, depending on their level and their use,
their personal
use
history
of,
with the music.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I've had two grad school auditions already, and my grad school audition at IU was spectacular. Mm-hmm. And the accompanist they had knew all the songs. She just sight read them and followed me perfectly. Mm-hmm. But then I just had one up in Minnesota, and the accompanist there, I'm pretty sure, was a grad student, and he didn't really look at my music. So he fumbled through it a lot, but I mean, he made it work.
Okay.
So you just kind of have to go on your own bearings and just hope they'll come along for the ride.
Excellent. Congratulations, you guys, on all your successes and your victories, I would say.
Thanks.
Thanks.
And thanks for coming, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the Producer's Vault, here's something from our weekly recital hour of February 6th, 2013. Here's junior piano performance major Weiying Tang performing the Allegro from Sonata Opus 13, No. 1 by Ludwig van Beethoven.
Thank you. This week, Professor Scott Spiegelberg stopped by for our Music That Moves Me segment, and he brought us Shostakovich's first piano concerto.
Hi, I'm Scott Spiegelberg, and I teach music theory here at DePauw University. Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 1 is Music That Moves Me. Dmitri Shostakovich composed the concerto for piano, trumpet, and orchestra in 1933. It was premiered by the Leningrad Philharmonic with Shostakovich himself playing the piano part. It was very well received, though at times Shostakovich was criticized for having a rather unemotional performance style himself. The concerto starts in a very Russian sound, with stark chords. You can picture the crystalline snow glistening on the steppes of Russia. All it is the piano at the beginning, strings slowly swelling underneath, but still with that icy demeanor to it. The piano concerto is actually written for piano with trumpet and strings, though it's not a standard double concerto. The piano definitely is the primary solo instrument, with the trumpet used more as comment upon the melodies that the piano is exuding. When the trumpet comes in, it often has either a very martial sound or a very humorous sound interjecting on what the piano had done, whether the piano is very lyrical or with the very icy Russian sounds as in an introduction. Later on, Shostakovich starts quoting a variety of different music, both from his own earlier works and from other people, such as Beethoven's Appassionata Sonata, folk songs from Russia, his own opera Hamlet. The concerto is in four movements. First movement's allegretto, second movement's lento, third movement and fourth movements are often recorded together in a single track, moderato moving into an allegro con brio. The third movement is very introductory. It feels like it flows into the fourth movement, hence why it's recorded that way. What really moves me about this entire concerto, and is demonstrated so aptly in this first movement, is the way that Shostakovich shifts from one emotion to another emotion. I'm able to experience a wide gamut of feelings within a relatively short period of time. Some of it is humorous, some of it is incredibly touching, some of it is romantic, some of it's sad. There's even martial feelings that can be stirred as we're going along. In the second movement, the slow lento, we're presented with a very slow, sad theme introduced by the strings. This theme seems to be evoking a feeling of sorrow, a funeral, very serious, somber tones. Trumpet comes in later, performing the very same theme, and yet it's in a low register of the trumpet, muted, which makes for a nasal buzz to this sound. It makes a very subtle humor, a very disturbing kind of humor, because it still is the sad, this funereal melody, and yet with this nasal, almost kazoo type of sound going along with it. So the torn feelings I get in hearing this, particularly as a trumpet player, knowing how difficult it is to play in that register and with the straight mute to try to achieve any sense of control, and no hope of getting an actual beautiful tone. It pulls me in two different directions at the same time, and I just thrill at that juxtaposition. Thank you. The fourth moment is a juxtaposition between the extreme virtuosity of the pianist and a very sarcastic rejoinders by the trumpet. The trumpet's playing clearly folk tunes, as well as, again, music from some of Shostakovich's own earlier works, some of his ballet music, some opera music, but always with this humor that has a dark undertone to it. Towards the end, the trumpet and the piano seem to agree, joining forces to end with a big flourish at the end, including quotations from Beethoven's Rondo alla Capriccia. Thank you. been taken through a journey of extreme emotions, sometimes several emotions at the same time, by Shostakovich's first piano concerto. This concerto moves me both for the reasons I mentioned, but also for personal reasons. As a young trumpeter, I performed the concerto many, many times, both studying the excerpts for auditions and getting chances to perform with small chamber groups. And so every time I hear this concerto, it reminds me of my youth and the journey I took on my road to being a musician. And that's why Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 1 moves me.
We just wrapped up an exciting opera week here at DePauw with our own take on Die Fledermaus called De Bat, and featured DePauw very prominently in this great opera. Student producer Matt Skiba brought in some student musicians to talk about life in the pits.
Welcome to the Student Corner. My name is Matt Skiba, and I'm one of the student producers here for Music for Life. With me today, I have freshman trombone player Gary Michael Potter and freshman violinist Sarah Jelka. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi.
As I understand it, you two are in the opera that DePauw is putting on called De Bat.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to just talk about the first year experience playing in the pit orchestra. How is playing in a pit orchestra different than playing in just a normal ensemble such as orchestra or concert band?
Well, it's actually a lot similar in the rehearsal process, but once you get down in the pit, you have to, all of a sudden you have these singers singing to your music, so you have to quiet down because they need to project over the audience. So there's a lot of adjustment happening, and also no one can see you, so you have to really hold yourself accountable to practicing because they're not going to know when you screw up, but you will.
Like she said, not much different. We have to pay more attention to the conductor because we're really revolving around the singers.
So kind of as you mentioned, no one can see you from where you're sitting. You're in the pit, you're under the stage. From where you two are sitting, can you see the show itself, though, as it progresses?
From where I'm sitting, I'm at the angle where it's actually very distracting. If I look up, I start to get engaged in the musical, and then I have to, you know, play. But at where I'm sitting, I can see pretty well, actually, what's going on stage. Can you, Gary?
I have a very small little window where I see mostly shenanigans performed by Mikey and a couple others. It's very distracting sometimes, but just got to stay focused and pull through.
You mentioned earlier that rehearsals are different when you're in the pit orchestra compared to when you are actually with the singers themselves. What has the rehearsal schedule been like for the entire pit orchestra?
Our rehearsal schedule has been pretty scattered, usually evenings, and we had a few rehearsals before winter term started, a few near the end of winter term, so basically whenever we could fit in a good rehearsal time.
And then when you got to the singers, you started rehearsing more and more?
More and more at night for larger periods of time, so we do a run through of the entire opera.
Was that pretty stressing endurance-wise for somebody like a brass player?
I rest a lot. It's actually very easy on me. There's rhythmic challenges, of course, being able to stay focused long enough to remember where you're at.
With this whole experience, how do you guys think you've grown as musicians?
I'd say it's a great experience for me, never having an orchestra at my high school, that I've been able to develop myself further just by being in this new experience. I get to actually be with more than just an ensemble. I'm also with the performers in the opera. Also, it's an entirely different feel for an ensemble, too. I went from being mostly just a concert band and marching band to an orchestra, which having very little experience in that itself has been able to develop me further as a musician. It's different music. It's just entirely a different feel than concert band. It's sometimes a little more formal, it feels, just in the music itself. Also, being with the upperclassmen, because I am one of the first-year students, and there's not very many of us in the opera, you get to deal with a lot of the better performers. It's a smaller section than just the orchestra, the opera pit is. And being able to listen to how differently it is in that confined area, like being in the opera pit compared to being in Kresge. It's also great because it just sounds different. You have to learn to look more than you listen.
Gary was talking about how in high school he was concert band and marching band style. You come from a high school with an orchestra, so how do you think this has changed you?
Well, I played in a lot of pit orchestras when I was in high school, so I'm used to that feel, but being in a different pit, there's a lot of adjustment, and just, I've never done an opera before. So I think with every musical that you play or that you sing, there's just a whole new feel and a new experience that you get that will change you as a musician.
So being in the pit orchestra this year for the opera, what would you guys define as your favorite experience?
I think actually my favorite experience has been since we've been rehearsing with the singers, just to see all of my friends get so into such a ridiculous opera and really see everyone come out of their shell. And it's nice in the pit too, because everyone really cares about the music. So it's a great bonding experience.
Say it's a lot of fun just to see the interaction between the performers and the orchestra, looking at all the people you know, now they're up there goofing around, dancing, making the show more fun for everyone else, not just them, but there's also kind of the aura from them interacts with the orchestra too, and it's just a good feeling to have this, and also to think I just played 2 hours and 15 minutes, and that was actually a lot of fun and awesome.
That's true, that's true. Well, we'd like to thank you for coming in and speaking with us today, and we hope to see you in the future operas that DePaul puts on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
One of the many exciting concert and recital opportunities that we have at DePaul are our faculty recitals. And on Tuesday, February 12th at 7:30 in Thompson Recital Hall, we have an exciting recital in store by our viola professor, Dr. Nicole Brockman, accompanied by her pianist, Dr. McCoy. Which is not this Dr. McCoy, it's actually another Dr. McCoy.
Yes, yes. And also with Tony Weinstein.
Oh, and Tony as well.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yep.
So this is an unusual construction that you're putting
together. It's a little unorthodox.
Yeah, so tell us about it. This is exciting.
Well, the years between about 1905 and 1920 are kind of the golden age of music written for the viola. And one of the highlights of that period was the year 1919, in which Elizabeth Sprigg Coolidge, who was an American patron of the arts, came into an inheritance, and she decided to use that money to sponsor a competition. And this was the Berkshire Chamber Music Composition Competition, which I always say incorrectly. And so this particular round was works for viola and piano.
So everything that year or just in that round of that competition?
Everything for that competition that year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Later versions of the competition were for other
instruments
right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
So submissions came in from all around the world. About 70, 72 submissions came in, and they're all submitted anonymously. And what ended up happening was that the judges got themselves into quite a state, and they were unable to declare a winner. And they had judged all of these compositions anonymously, not knowing who had written mm-hmm. any of them. And so after they had been deadlocked, the identity of one of the finalists was revealed to them, and there was just a huge hubbub. They said, this person could not possibly have written this piece. There's some mistake. Somebody is using a pseudonym. Somebody is submitting it as somebody else. And so it was just kind of a big hubbub. Eventually, Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge herself had to break the tie.
Wow.
Which was interesting.
And was she a musician?
She was a musician. She commissioned some works in her life mm-hmm. that she performed on.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, being a woman and a musician, not really a compatible professional right. career choice.
Right.
So what we're going to do on Tuesday is that I'm going to play the three finalist works from this competition without revealing to the audience who wrote them. And the audience is going to get, with their programs, little colored slips of paper, which after the third finalist piece, they're going to be asked to vote by putting a colored piece of paper that represents a particular mm-hmm. work into the basket.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ballots will be counted. And we're going to see how today's audience would rank
uh-huh.
these compositions without knowing anything about who wrote them.
Wow, that's fascinating. So this is truly the recreation
yes,
of the finals round.
It's a restaging, yeah.
And maybe we can even get an argument to break out and have a tie.
We could. We could. And then we'll talk about what actually happened at the competition and why there was such a hubbub. And
we'll reveal
the big reveal. Piece. Exactly.
The big reveal comes at the end.
Yeah.
This will be after several commercial announcements.
Of course. And sponsorships.
You know, sponsorships, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Reality TV has taken over. This is great. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, this brings up an interesting question, because for our audiences, which are comprised of music students, College for Liberal Arts students, music faculty, CLA faculty, community members, wide variety of folks, everybody in that room is going to bring a different rubric to bear to judge this. We would assume that in the original, that did not happen. They might have brought their own personal preferences, but they would have all had a similar rubric to operate from in choosing. Now, this I find very interesting. Having judged thousands of performances in my life, this is really a kind of bizarre thing we've gotten ourselves into, isn't it?
Well, a little bit, yeah.
How does one decide what is a better composition than another?
I've thought about that a lot. When I teach classes that deal with aesthetics and the formation of musical canons, the question comes up always of what does the popularity of a work, mm-hmm. the immediate audience appeal of a work, how does that contribute towards the work's longevity
mm-hmm.
or to its overall, merit as compared to other works? And what I think I have learned over the years is that no matter how good a piece may be from an intellectual craft standpoint, if the audience doesn't like it,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to get traction.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that any composer always has to balance the craft of what they're doing with a need to be accessible.
Exactly, because there's actually two disparate angles that this might take. One is that it's incredibly popular. It's beautiful. It's lovely. Everyone loves it. And it's kind of like top 40 music. 16 weeks later, it's fallen off the charts.
Right.
Because we used it up. It was really, think Macarena here, or whatever, you insert whatever.
Gangnam style.
So you have this thing that you use up very quickly, and then it's of no value. Compared then to some really profoundly written, carefully crafted piece of work, think Hindemith, that is brilliant in every way, but doesn't catch the audience. Well, those are the extremes of this. Somewhere in that continuum between one end and the other is kind of the golden mean.
Yeah, kind of the sweet spot, yeah.
Right, and that is an interesting question, because if it's too much of one, we lose interest. If it's too much of the other, we never get interested at all.
Right.
And somewhere between there, it has to exist. And for us as the audience judging on Tuesday night, we're going to be leaning more toward the what appealed to us at this moment, because we're hearing it on a single hearing.
Exactly.
It's interesting that in many performances of classical music in the early days, they would perform the entire work down, stop, and then play the entire work again.
Because that's not happening on Tuesday.
I wasn't giving you a suggestion. Fear not. But the idea of this was that it's so new, you need to hear it twice.
Right.
Nowadays, even though we all love to go hear another Brahms symphony or a Mahler or Mozart or whatever, we've got 1,000 recordings of it, so we can get to know the work outside of the concert hall and then appreciate it in a single hearing. This is not going to be the case on Tuesday night.
No, it's not.
People are going to really be listening and absorbing at one time.
Yes, and of the three works, I would say that one of them is fairly well known, one of them is somewhat well known, and one of them will be new for almost everybody in the audience.
Mm, wow. Now, here's a big question. Who wins in your eyes? Do you have a winner, or are they all equal, or would you be able to vote?
It's funny, Darcy asked me at our rehearsal the other day whether she was going to be able to vote.
Darcy McCoy, can I vote?
And I said, sure, you can go vote. And I thought, if I had to vote, I don't know
really
what I would pick. Yeah, because I appreciate them in very different ways. One of the pieces, the one that I think is the most compositionally rich, was a hard sell for me the first time that I heard it. Mm-hmm. And it's only with repeated performances that you become, as you were alluding to earlier, as you become familiar with how all of the different parts of it interact,
mm-hmm.
that it starts to become intellectually fascinating, which I think is great. And other parts of the program appeal immediately. So it would be like asking me to choose my favorite child. So yeah, let's not do that.
Yeah, let's not do that. And I think you've kind of headed toward the answer to this question that also fascinates me, and that is, would your favorite work as a listener be different than your favorite work as the performer of that work?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There are certainly composers whose music I would rather play than listen to.
Hmm.
And there are also composers whose music I'd rather listen to than play.
Yeah, who was it that said his music is far greater than it sounds?
Oh.
That's a great line. Yes. I can't, it slips me at the moment, but a great moment.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. His music's far greater than it sounds. That's one of my favorite quotes. The other one is Rossini's quote about Wagner that said he had some great moments, but some terrible half hours.
Right.
Yeah. So as you have been working through this process, you're bringing three really tough works to the stage in the same evening.
Yeah, I discovered that that's why nobody does this program.
I was just thinking that. I mean, who does this? I mean, this is like the Lance Armstrong, well, no, not Lance Armstrong anymore, but this is
like
Herculean.
No, I'm not on steroids. I promise
you. I don't know.
We're
going to check
for
you.
No, yeah.
You're not taking any enhancement drugs to get through this recital on Tuesday night, are you?
Nope, nope.
The International Doping, Viola Doping Agency will be here to check on you. This has got to be tough.
Yeah, it's a huge program.
It is. And how do you prepare yourself for that?
Well,
do you play them all 3 weeks? I mean, I guess this is like a marathon runner. I mean, you don't just go out and run marathons every day to prepare for a marathon. How do you pace yourself here?
Oh, you don't? I've been doing that wrong.
Oh.
I think that the important thing to do is to not think about it as one long evening. You know, that when you're in one work, you're in that work 100%. And so you do that work and you are in that kind of sonic energy landscape. And then you leave that one and you go on to the next one. So it's not so much.
That's a good philosophy.
Yeah, I don't think of it as being here, you know, here's an hour and a half of really hard music.
Right.
It's here's three individual little sound worlds to explore.
Right. It's kind of like the runner. You know, there were times back in the day when I was a runner, there were times I could look at the finish line. There were other times I couldn't even imagine the finish line. I just wanted to look at my feet and hope they kept moving.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of that process, because it's one thing to have the mental stamina to hear these works all in a row and to begin to keep them straight and understand, but then to perform them, you know, that's a Herculean task. So bravo for taking this on. This is an exciting and innovative way to present a recital, and one of the many ways that DuPois is attempting to be more reflective of the current society. What the opera we just finished last weekend was an example of that. And this is, it's a completely different way to come to a recital and truly set yourself into a situation that existed and recreate that. And I'm interested to see where we turn out.
Yeah, it will be interesting to hear the audience's thoughts on how they judged.
Mm-hmm. How they decided what they decided, exactly.
And so from a pedagogical standpoint, as a faculty member, that's very interesting to me, how our students are learning to make judgments and evaluations of the works that they're going to be interacting with on a daily basis.
Okay. This is fascinating. Thanks for coming in to chat about it.
My pleasure.
And lots of stamina and no steroids between now
and then. Okay, I promise.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
From the Producer's Vault, here's a piece from our weekly recital hour of February 6th, 2013. This is sophomore piano performance major Rachel Robin performing the Allegro con Brio from the Sonata in C Major, Opus 2, Number 3, by Ludwig van Beethoven.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Music for Life. We love hearing from listeners. You can contact us by emailing musicforlife@depauw.edu. Our student producers are Adam Luman, Anna Gatdula, and Matthew Skiba. Our online editor is Veronica Pedro, and our show is produced and recorded by Matthew Champagne in the Judson and Joyce Green Center for the Performing Arts at DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana. I'm Mark McCoy, Dean of the School of Music. Thanks for listening to our show. Keep music in your life, and have a great week. Thank you.
It's Music for Life.